Hello, this is Janice Schweizer with a Pantograph for Tuesday, August 4th, 2026. We begin on the first page with Illinois elections. Feds denied voter data. U.S. judge rejects order for unredacted records by Peter Hancock with Capital News Illinois. A federal judge ruled late Friday that Illinois is not required to hand over its complete, unredacted voter registration data, including sensitive personal information, to the Trump administration. In a 14-page opinion, Judge Colleen Lawless reached the same conclusion as judges in 18 other federal districts and one appellate circuit who have ruled in nearly identical cases. She found that the Civil Rights Act of 1960 does not give the U.S. Attorney General, quote, general auditing power, close quote, to demand voter data. No court has yet ruled in favor of the administration's demand for voter data. She also said the Department of Justice failed to provide any factual basis for suggesting state officials have done anything wrong in maintaining the state's voter registration database, and that it offered no legitimate purpose for seeking the information. Quote, the Attorney General's demand is deficient in both its stated basis and purpose and cannot be enforced against Illinois State Board of Elections Executive Director Bernadette Matthews, Lawless wrote. The Justice Department began demanding access to state's unredacted voter registration rolls shortly after President Donald Trump took office for a second term in 2025. The lists include sensitive personal information such as dates of birth, driver's license numbers, and partial Social Security numbers, what election law expert David Becker has referred to as, quote, the holy trinity of identity theft, close quote. In August 2025, the State Elections Board gave DOG a copy of its statewide voter registration database with sensitive information redacted. That is the same information it makes available to candidate committees and political parties, but lawyers for the DOJ said that was insufficient. In its petitions, DOJ said it needed the complete database to ascertain whether states were meeting their legal duties under federal laws to maintain accurate and up-to-date voter rolls and to take affirmative steps to purge the rolls of ineligible voters, including non-citizens. The DOJ cited a provision of the Civil Rights Act giving the Attorney General authority to, quote, demand in writing, close quote, from state election officials any, quote, record or paper related to an election that has taken place in the previous 22 months. But attorneys representing outside groups that intervened in the Illinois case argued that was only a pretext, and that the DOJ's real purpose was to purge state voter rolls of suspected non-citizens by cross-checking their rolls with a national citizenship database. In her opinion, Lawless did not address that alternate theory about DOJ's motives. Instead, she focused on the agency's stated reasons. She said the Civil Rights Act does not give federal investigators blanket authority to demand records from state election officials, and that it requires them to show both a basis and purpose for the demand. Lawyers for the Justice Department argued that they met that obligation simply by citing the legal authority that the statute gives to demand the information. But Lawless rejected that argument. Quote, if the Attorney General could simply justify this demand with a statement of any purpose whatsoever, the requirement that he specify his purpose and his basis would be pointless, and it would provide him with unfettered authority to demand voting records, close quote. She said the Civil Rights Act of 1960 was enacted to combat racial discrimination in voting, and that a demand for records under that law, quote, must relate to Congress's rationale behind granting the Attorney General investigatory authority over certain federal voting records, close quote. Quote again, Congress did not confer a general auditing power to the Department of Justice over state election officials, the judge wrote. Also on the front page from Ben Zielinski with Capital News Illinois, is Social Media Access to Kids Limited. Governor J.B. Pritzker signed sweeping regulations Friday aimed at social media companies and cracking down on addictive algorithms that keep kids glued to their screens. House Bill 5511, known as the Children's Social Media Safety Act, imposes a series of requirements on social media companies and how they are to interact with users under 18 years old. The law, which will take effect in 2028, was one of Pritzker's top priorities during the spring legislative session and received unanimous support in both chambers. Quote, big social media companies have intentionally designed their platforms to keep kids online for as long as possible, close quote, Pritzker said before signing the bill at an event in Chicago. Quote, their algorithms learn what captures a child's attention, which most often seems to be anger and euphoria, and then the algorithm keeps feeding them more of that. Why? The almighty dollar. They feed our kids an unrealistic picture of life and sell them products and agendas to achieve it, close quote. Under the law, social media platforms must confirm a user's age through the device's operating system. When devices are set up for children, parents would set the child's age, which would automatically trigger certain restrictions required by the state. To limit the addictive nature of social media feeds, the law prohibits companies from using a minor's viewing history or data stored on the device to determine what shows up in their feeds. Instead, feeds for minors will only be allowed to show information the user requested or searched for or was posted by a creator the user follows. Kids will also be able to see media that is a direct private message to them. These are common sense protections, Pritzker said. They don't prevent young people from connecting with one another or their loved ones online. They don't censor anyone. They take decisions about children's online safety away from the companies and put it back in the hands of the parents. Stronger default privacy settings are also not required for minors, including shielding a minor's precise location and limiting digital currency transactions. I'm sorry, I read that wrong. Stronger default privacy settings are also required for minors, including shielding a minor's precise location and limiting the digital currency transactions. Social media sites and apps would also be prohibited from sending notifications to minors between 10 p.m. and 7 a.m. What we're seeing is shrinking attention spans, rising depression rates, and in kids sacrificing sleep to scroll long past when they should be asleep. And it's a real danger, House Bill sponsor Representative Jennifer Gongsiewicz, a Democrat from Glenview, said. The Illinois Attorney General's office would enforce the law. Violators would be liable for fines up to $2,500 for each child for unintentional violations and up to $7,500 per child for intentional violations. It is important that we balance the guardrails that keep young people safe, guardrails that technology companies should have implemented from the very beginning, Attorney General Kwame Raoul said. Raoul has joined lawsuits against both Meta and TikTok, alleging the companies have addictive designs that exploit children. The law was generally opposed by tech companies. During testimony in committees this spring, lobbyists for the companies raised concerns that the bill would violate First Amendment rights and potentially trigger lawsuits against the state. The final version of the bill was opposed by the Illinois Chamber of Commerce, Motion Picture Association, tech company advocacy organization TechNet, and the American Civil Liberties Union. Quote, innovation and child safety are not competing interests, bill sponsor Senator Willie Preston, a Democrat from Chicago, said. Quote, you do not have to choose between technological progress and protecting children. The greatest innovations solve problems. They do not create them. Olivia Jacobs with the Pantograph writes, "An Dawath offers an Indian feast. Eatery promises regional cuisines and fine family dining." Dawath, United Kitchens of India, a new restaurant featuring a feast of traditional regional Indian cuisines, has opened in Bloomington with a lofty goal. "We want to serve the best food Bloomington Normal has ever experienced," said Vivek Gangangari, who helped create the restaurant. The Hindi word Dawath refers to an invitation to a feast, and that's the spirit owners say they want to present at the restaurant located at 503 North Prospect Road, Unit 201, between Smash House Tavern and Bloom Barwachi. The Dawath team said they wanted to provide a welcoming atmosphere, a menu that responds to customer feedback, fresh ingredients from their own grocery store, and fast, expert servers who can guide diners through the menu options. "Come with family, and then you know it's like a family gathering, and then come here, eat, and then relax," said Naveen Mattisetti, one of the owners. Four partners are involved in the business: Mattisetti, Dinesh Jayasinga, Krishna Kanaganti, and Rajesh Yarlagada. Gangangari also helps with the business, which took about a year to establish from start to finish. "It took us some time, but it was worth it. After seeing the customers appreciating the interiors and everything, we thought it was well worth it, time well spent." The restaurant officially opened on June 23rd with a takeout menu and then began in-house dining a few days later. "For the last month, we were under soft launch, but we are ready for the grand launch next week, August 4th. Mattisetti has been in Bloomington since 2008 when he began working for State Farm. In 2021, he decided to branch out into entrepreneurship and opened an information technology consulting company. He ultimately began purchasing real estate throughout the area. In 2022, the partners opened the Bloom Bazaar Indian Grocery and Meat Store featuring halal meat and more, and then opened additional locations in Springfield, Champaign, and Peoria. Mattisetti said they're planning to expand their snack offerings. Mattisetti said their goal was to make Dawath look like a five-star restaurant because it's not something found in the area, and to have great customer service. "Our main goal was to create this as a one-stop solution for everybody. So basically, if you come for the grocery store, you get your groceries, your meat, everything, and if you want to dine in, you can dine in as well," Gangangari explained. "We wanted to bring that fine dining to Bloomington, a unique premium family dining experience." The name of the restaurant also refers to the fact India is not just about one cuisine, but many varied regional ones. The owners said they wanted to bring as many of the cuisines under one roof as possible. Gangangari added, noting they plan to add more depending on customer demand. He also noted they planned for their chefs based on the concept rather than shaping the restaurant around the chefs, and so far everyone is enjoying and taking pictures when they visit. And while the restaurant hasn't introduced its full menu yet, Dawath currently features seven different signature items that have been hits among customers, including different biryanis as the number one item, golden garlic prawns, butter chicken, chicken tikka masala, bani dosa, and chicken and goat starters. Dawath offers both indoor and outdoor dining with a patio in the front of the restaurant. It has capacity for about 90 customers inside and an additional 35 to 40 on the patio. Service is also available on DoorDash. The owners said they keep in mind that Bloomington draws diners from the neighboring towns. So whoever is traveling or anything, they always stop by Bloomington for food, Peoria, Springfield, and whoever is traveling on I-55. They said they hope customers who are trying Indian food for the first time will come in with an open mind and consider suggestions from their trained servers and food runners. And they promise when they taste the food, they will leave happy. Drew Zimmerman writes, "Downs Touts Water Plant, Village Open House marks remodeled facilities anniversary." Despite construction setbacks and a few glitches with new equipment, Downs's remodeled water treatment plant has provided clean water to residents for close to a year. On Saturday, Public Works staff held an open house for the new facility, which required a $6 million investment. Quincy Combs, a village employee who served as construction consultant during the remodel, said water treatment at the original plant was as basic as it gets. Well water would run through a filtration system to remove the solids, get disinfected with chlorine, and get sent out to residents' taps. However, water would still be a brownish color after the treatment. Treated water from the remodel plant was first introduced to the village on August 22nd of last year. However, Public Works crews were still flushing lines to remove any residual sediment, according to a social media post from the village. Decommissioning the former plant's operations took place in the weeks that followed. At that time, water was 60% softened. But over the next month, water softening levels reached 75 to 80%, which is considered ideal, village officials said. Once the water reached that level, households were advised they no longer needed water softeners, reverse osmosis systems, or bottled water. The remodel plant is a demineralization plant that includes cation treatment, which uses resin to absorb iron and other heavy metals from the well water following filtration. Combs said the water then gets flushed out every few days and resembles black coffee once it's disposed. Water then undergoes anion treatment, which removes many of the dissolved salts and produces water with low conductivity. Together, these two treatments removed most dissolved minerals. The filtration also includes chlorinization and the addition of phosphate to coat the pipes and prevent leaching. A minimal amount of fluoride is also added. A separate booster pump pushes water to Downs Crossing, which sits at a higher elevation than the plant. Combs said, although the project did not require a lot of water main work on site, 3 miles of water main work was required to reach Downs Crossing. Combs said several beneficial solids, such as magnesium and potassium, still exist within the water at levels that are within the recommendations of the Environmental Protection Agency. He added that the drinking water may be the only access some residents have to the minerals it contains. Sometimes you need that mineral, so there's nothing wrong with it being in there, Combs said. Once the plant was operational last fall, Downs Mayor Mike James said residents were advised to turn off their water softeners because if the water is over-softened, it can feed off metal and cause pipes to break down. Although some companies advise residents to keep their water softeners connected, James encouraged these individuals to call the village to have their water softness tested. From a plant operational standpoint, everything brand new has its own glitch, so we're dealing with those, James said. For the most part, the plant is doing a great job producing bottle quality water. Also from Drew Zimmerman, we have cyclist struck and killed by vehicle. McLean County authorities are investigating a fatal crash Sunday evening that involved a cyclist. According to a joint news release from the county's sheriff and coroner's offices, deputies and Bloomington police were dispatched at 5:05 p.m. to 1907 West Washington Street for a report of a utility vehicle striking a bicyclist. When they arrived, officers attempted to provide medical aid to the man who had been riding a bicycle. Kathleen Yoder arrived on scene and he was pronounced deceased, according to the release. The collision remains under the investigation of the McLean County Coroner's Office, McLean County Sheriff's Office, and the McLean County Accident Reconstruction Team. Also, fire damages Clinton House, no injuries. A residential fire reported in Clinton Sunday night resulted in no injuries and is not believed to be suspicious in nature, according to a social media post from the Clinton Fire Department. At 6:57 p.m., Clinton firefighters and automatic aid partners were dispatched to 56 Holiday Drive for a reported residential fire. At the time, Clinton Rescue had just finished a medical call at Goldwater Care, 1 Park Lane. Mutual aid crews from Kenny, Wapella, and Maroa were also called to assist, while members of the Waynesville Fire Department covered Clinton's station. When crews arrived, they discovered heavy fire conditions from the second floor windows. The homeowner advised everyone was out of the house and he had no pets, according to the release. After an aggressive interior attack and the ventilation of the roof, the fire was under control. The incident is being investigated by the Office of the Illinois State Fire Marshal, but it is not considered suspicious in nature. We have a page titled, Trump Administration, Strong but Stalled. Economy resilient, but many of President's vows still unfulfilled. This is by Howard Schneider and Saqib Iqbal Ahmed with Reuters. The first 18 months of President Donald Trump's second White House term saw policy-driven economic shocks, highlighted by an immigration crackdown, higher tariffs, and a war that boosted the price of oil and threatened global supply chains. While the U.S. economy overall withstood the policy changes and Middle East war better than many economists expected, Trump's vows to lower prices, boost factory jobs, and improve life for the middle class have yet to materialize. The economy also stalled in many areas where Trump said mass deportations of undocumented people and higher import taxes would trigger a boom, with the war intensifying some key risks. The broadest measure of employment comes from the Bureau of Labor Statistics Household Survey. Changes in population statistics this year mean BLS data is not strictly comparable from year to year, showing a sharp drop in employment and the number of people looking for jobs in January, largely due to the new controls. The agency used the new population estimates for an experimental series that looked back 5 years to create a consistent data set. That data also shows declines in the labor force and number of people working since Trump's return to office, as he sought to limit immigration and increase deportations. Coupled with an aging native population, fewer people are available to fill jobs. There was an investment boom in artificial intelligence data centers, but its effects on output and jobs remains to be seen. The AI investment pushed construction employment higher. However, payroll reports show fewer manufacturing jobs than there were at the end of Democratic former President Joe Biden's administration in January of 2025. Some of Trump's priorities are reflected in the jobs data, such as the drop in the number of government workers. Home ownership remains out of reach. An Atlanta Federal Home Affordability Monitor, including sales prices and things like property taxes, shows home ownership remains out of reach for many households. Housing costs of about 30% of annual income are considered the limit of affordability. Trump veered from promising to make life more affordable to dismissing that objective as unimportant, refusing to sign legislation aimed at improving home affordability. After years of ultra-low interest rates, the COVID-19 pandemic added fuel to the U.S. housing market, driving up home prices, and then Fed rate hikes meant to curb inflation pushed mortgage rates to new heights. Home insurance premiums linked to higher home values and other relevant costs also remain elevated. The federal government can do only so much about housing supply. Extending tax credit or similar policies can help, but the sector remains under the control of local governments and their land use and zoning rules. Home ownership continues to command an outsized share of household income. We have real income stalls. On an inflation-adjusted basis, the amount of money going to families month to month has stalled. Tight labor markets after the pandemic fueled gains even with higher inflation. Weaker wage growth and cuts to government transfer payments have meant less spending power even as inflation moderated. Setting aside the debate about a K-shaped income distribution, in which the wealthy and the highest earners prosper, while lower and middle income households fare less well, consumer spending held up throughout the Trump era shocks. It is unclear how long that trend can continue, given the broadest measure of household spending power, disposable personal income adjusted for inflation, has stalled out and recently declined. Trump touted major indices' recent record highs as evidence of his policy's successes. However, stocks tend to rise over time regardless of who is president, and most modern U.S. leaders saw record equity prices during their terms. The market's performance since January 2025 ranks in the middle of the pack when measured against presidents going back to Ronald Reagan. The S&P 500 index gained about 25% during Trump's second term versus a median gain of about 24% over the first 18 months of presidential terms dating back to 1981. That performance still measures up well against the overall compound annual growth rate of 9.5% for stocks in that period. The AI sector, the single largest driver of the business investment boom supporting GDP growth, was a major driver of the stock market gains in Trump's current term. Year to date, the corporate bond issuance of $1.52 trillion through the end of June, a big chunk of it to finance the AI buildout, also is on a record pace. Strong issuance combined with tight spreads and robust demand point to a resilient economy and solid corporate balance sheets. But lowering inflation is possible, but improvement under Trump was only modest. The most closely watched price indices show progress stalling, with inflation still above the Federal Reserve's 2% target and policymakers concerned about the risk of it moving higher. Import tariffs added to the price hikes to some degree. Oil surged to about $100 a barrel, about 50% more than where it traded before the U.S. and Israel started the war against Iran on February 28th, has added to the pressure. Now demands from the AI buildout are doing the same. And from the Chicago Tribune, we have marchers recall MLK visit. Crowds brave rain to retrace 1966 civil rights protest by Lila Hempel Edgers. The heavy rains that shuttered the third morning of Lollapalooza failed to dampen the crowds that marched toward Marquette Park on Saturday, retracing the very route the Reverend Martin Luther King, Jr. walked 60 years ago. While the violent mobs who hurled stones at marchers in 1966 are long gone, civil rights advocates say their demands remained strikingly familiar and that the threat to democracy has not disappeared. "We're living in a time when human dignity is being dismissed," said the Reverend Bernice King, the civil rights leader's youngest child. "And in the midst of this trembling, we stand on the ground where my father once stood." King joined faith leaders and civil rights advocates from across the country to honor those who challenged housing segregation, racial injustice, and systemic inequality decades ago. Together, they argued, the anniversary was not only a remembrance of past victories, but a reminder that the work remains unfinished. Crowds began gathering at the intersection of 63rd Street and South Kedzie Avenue around 9 a.m., 2 hours before stepping into the streets. Huddled beneath colorful umbrellas, they cheered community leaders and sang songs of liberation. Many attended in protest of the immigration enforcement operations that have intensified as the Trump administration expanded its deportation campaign. "Racism is alive and well in Chicago," said Wallace, who lives in Western Springs. "God bless Dr. Martin Luther King, but I'm so sorry that we have to still be marching in his footsteps." And with that, we complete the reading of Part 1 of the Pantograph for Tuesday, August 4th, 2026. I'm Janice Schweizer, and I will return shortly with Part 2.